Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, behind fatal shootings of African Americans, race relations, police culture, and society. And first, new science show how parasites change behaviors throughout the animal kingdom. For many years, scientists and philosophers have explored how much human behavior is programmed and how much is actually free will. But now, there's another factor, parasites. Parasites have been found to change animal behaviors, sometimes quite drastically. What does that mean for human behavior? Dixon DePommier is with us. He is a microbiologist, ecologist, and emeritus professor at Columbia University. His books include The Vertical Farm, Feeding the World in the 21st Century, and People, Parasites, and Plowshares, Learning from Our Body's Most Terrifying Invaders. Patrick House also joins us. He's a neuroscientist at Stanford University and the author of a key paper about how one parasite makes rodents lose their fear of cats. Welcome to the two of you. Thank you so much for being with us.
Pleasure.
Dr. DePommier, I would like to start with kind of the basics on the relationship of parasites to animal behavior. I understand parasites feed on their hosts, but sometimes they drive the behaviors of their hosts. What are some examples of this?
Absolutely. There are lots of them. In fact, there are many more to be discovered since we have only recently, I think, come to realize that nature has a series of interlocking behaviors associated with systems that tend to reinforce each other. So parasitism is a system. I don't mean to sound highfalutin on this, but everybody has a basic concept of what an ecosystem is. And if you can imagine all the plants and animals that live within a given region that could be defined as an ecosystem, virtually all those animals and plants that you can see turn out to be what we would call free-living animals or plants. If you look inside them, however, you will find that they have a collection of other organisms. Some of them are good, like the organisms that live inside our intestinal tract, for instance, the bacteria, and some of the viruses as well. But there are other organisms called parasites, which are there to take advantage of these, what we would call successful systems. So in order to do that, of course, these parasites have to be able to get from one host to another. And some of them, not all of them, but some of them alter the behavior of their hosts in order to ensure the fact that they'll be transmitted from one animal or one plant to another. And you asked me for examples. I'll just give you the one that I find the most fascinating, but I'm sure there are tons of them out there. It involves a parasite called Spirometramansinoides. It's a tapeworm. And this tapeworm lives inside the small intestinal tract of cats and other felines like, bobcats and panthers and tigers and things of this sort. In order to catch this tapeworm, the cat or feline has to catch another animal and eat it because the parasite has a stage that lives inside the other animal. Well, it turns out that most of these other animals that cats have to catch in order to eat turn out to be either snakes or fish or amphibians. And they're usually pretty fast, especially the amphibians. They tend to jump and hide. You know, they crawl up trees and they escape from their predators, which is the cat. But this particular parasite secretes something, we think we know what it is now, something into its what we would call the host that will give the cat the parasite, in this case a frog, that makes the frog grow uncontrollably so that the frog actually gets bigger and slower and more sluggish, just like we would get if we were to eat too much and become obese. These obese frogs containing the stage that the cat needs to catch in order to get the tapeworm become very easy for the cats to catch. And so as a result, the parasite has modified the behavior of the stage of the infection that the cat needs to come in contact with in order to complete the life cycle. Now, that's pretty sophisticated biology, but I mean, it gives you an example of how complicated and how complex life has become through, I would say, billions of years of evolution. There are plenty of other examples like this.
I read about one parasite that actually rewires an ant's brain, its neurons, and then kind of hijacks its body.
That's correct. So that the ant becomes eaten by something else, and then that gives that something else the stage of the parasite that it needs to go on with its life. That's true for a lot of associations that you can find in nature. The more you look for them, the more you find them.
How often do you see this kind of behavior alterations in higher-level animals? What about human beings?
I'm not a a psychiatrist, nor am I a psychologist. I'm a parasitologist, although in some cases people have mistaken that name and asked me if I was a parapsychologist. So the answer is I'm a parasitologist. And the examples that I could give you from nature's enormous volumes of stories along these lines is the one that I think maybe Patrick House could be better to explain with regards to, I believe you're referring to Toxoplasma gondii, which is a protozoan parasite. And in fact, it's probably the most widely distributed infectious agent on the planet. Not only does it infect all mammals, but it infects most of the cells inside of most mammals. So it's almost a universal parasite. John Boothroyd, who also works at Stanford, he almost is convinced that this, in many cases, is not a parasite, but rather is a symbiont.
And it's rather a what? I'm sorry, say that again.
A symbiont.
A symbiont.
That actually helps in some ways to stimulate the immune system and to keep the organisms alive long enough to allow these parasites to be transmitted to other animals over long distances. That becomes a strategy. I mean, a parasite might want to keep its host alive for a long time in order to move away from the source of infection so that other animals can also become infected. So we have these strategies that parasites have evolved as well.
Patrick House, let's bring you in. You have been studying this particular parasite, and one of your findings pertains to how it changes the behavior of rats and makes them more vulnerable to their predators, cats. What happens?
One of the interesting things is that if you actually look at this broad range of parasites that manipulate their host behavior, you actually find most of them in insects. So it'll change the behavior of maybe an ant or maybe a cricket. There are examples of these particular ones. Also, I believe a cockroach. There's one wasp that will actually inject something into a cockroach. But if you think about it, on the level of complexity, these are actually rather simple organisms, insects. I mean, they don't have brains per se as we define them. And what I think makes this particular Toxoplasma parasite interesting is that actually it's one of very few things, if not the only thing that we know of, that actually gets into mammalian brains, sits there, and doesn't actually end up killing the host. This idea that the parasite may actually be sitting in the brain for years, months, kind of across the vast majority of the host's life is interesting, because then you can ask, well, what, if any, possible changes in behavior are there? Because, you know, the brain is the seat of a lot of these, of what we consider to be will. So this particular parasite has to get and can only sexually reproduce. And by sexually, I mean it can only combine its genes around inside the cat. So again, we have cat as an origin for one of the most interesting things in kind of this manipulation hypothesis for parasites. So the parasite is actually stuck in a cat. It has to get from one cat to another cat. How does it do that? It doesn't have legs of its own. And it uses rats and mice and other intermediate hosts to actually ferry itself, to kind of taxi from one cat to the other cat. And what we think is happening is that it's getting into the brain of these rats and somehow making it such that that individual rat is more likely to then get eaten by the cat, which passes on the parasite. And my work has shown, when I looked in the brains of the rats that had this parasite and exposed them to a cat, it actually looked similar to when we took an uninfected animal, uninfected male rat, and exposed it to a female rat. Well, one possibility is that you're making them less afraid of the cat. And another possibility is that you're actually making them attracted to the cat. So what I showed is that maybe there's some hint that what's actually happening is this parasite is making these rats actually attracted to the smell of cats.
Which then makes them prey.
Which then makes them spend more time where cats are, which then makes them more likely to get eaten. I mean, there's a very good reason that rats are, rats and mice alike, anything that a cat, you know, predates, is quite afraid of the smell of a cat because it means imminent doom.
This really does raise the question whether or not we have free will. There's certainly the evolutionary aspect anyway, certain programming, but now we're talking about microorganisms having effect over animal behavior. This particular parasite, Patrick House, that you've been studying is also present in people. What's the scope of the presence and how does it affect people that we know of?
Estimates are maybe a fifth to a third of the world, entire world, all six, seven, I don't know how many there are anymore, 6 or 7 billion people. So it is one of definitely the most common parasites in the world. And you might then ask, if you're getting into numbers that large, at what point we can even really figure out what, if anything, this parasite's doing. So people mostly get it, we believe, through eating raw meat. The parasite ends up in a lot of different animals, a lot of different mammals, including cows, sheep, pigs, goats, everything that we eat. And in countries that seem to eat more raw meat, you tend to get higher infection rates. So France and Brazil, steak tartare, Brazilian barbecues, things like that, you actually have some of the highest rates in the world in these two countries. Another possible route is through cat ownership. So the parasite is actually transmitted through the cat poop. And if you don't clean your litter, or rather, if you clean your litter box well and don't clean your hands well afterwards, people can often ingest it that way. So people do have it. We definitely know that people have it in their brains. And the question is, what, if anything, is it doing? So even if we know that it's changing rat behavior, that gives us no certain indicator that it's changing human behavior, because our brains are, you know, they're similar in some respects, but they're very, very different in many. And one of the interesting things is, well, you have the parasite sitting in a rat brain for maybe a few months, maybe a few years. They don't live very long. But when you have it in a human, and you have it in a human for decades, is it possible that something is coming out, some perturbation is happening that is just very difficult to recognize? So we really don't know. I mean, if you go into a doctor's office and you have toxoplasma, just the parasite, you just test for the parasite and you do have it, you can do a blood test and they'll tell you. That doctor will do nothing special for you. You are not considered sick. That's not a disease in and of itself. So right now, clinically, there's no consequence to having the parasite.
One of the illnesses that I saw had a correlation with this particular toxoplasma was schizophrenia.
Yes.
Do we know if the correlation means anything yet?
I want to make two caveats to what I just said, which is that it is very dangerous in two cases. One being if you're immunocompromised. So in HIV patients, for example, which is one way that a human can become immunocompromised, toxoplasmosis, which is the actual clinical version, can be fatal. In addition, it can be very, very bad for fetuses. If a pregnant woman picks up the parasite for the first time, the same way that the parasite gets into our brain, it can actually get into the baby's brain. So there are circumstances. I didn't mean to say that it was just a harmless parasite. As to the kind of correlations with mental illness, so this is, I think, one of the most interesting things about this, and really the reason I'm studying it. And what I would say is that we know, for instance, for just with schizophrenia, that there are people with schizophrenia that do not have this parasite, and there are people with this parasite that do not have schizophrenia. So it's not a one-to-one link. By no means will it turn out. I mean, many, many more people have the parasite in the world, like I said, maybe up to a third, than do schizophrenia. But it's one of these really tricky things where we don't really know what causes schizophrenia to begin with, and we don't really know what this parasite does. So when you're asking about the correlation between the two, you're really asking to kind of make a link between two things we don't know much about. The kind of strongest link that we have out there is maybe between 50 and 60 studies now have shown that if you have schizophrenia, you're more likely to have this parasite. That's certainly interesting. Like, that's the first nugget of how scientific hypotheses develop, and now we have to investigate that further. But it's quite likely that actually what could happen, maybe, just as an example, people with schizophrenia tend to have poor hygiene, tend to take less good care of themselves. And that could actually lend to maybe undercooking your meat or not washing your hands, or, you know, schizophrenia can make you more likely to pick up the parasite.
Let me thank you, Patrick House, and let me also thank Dixon DePommier.
Thank you.
When we come back, behind fatal shootings of African Americans, race relations, police culture, and society. Stay tuned.
Wishes them in the broken heart, feel the open palm, part in my flowing thoughts, my departure from the norm, the parts that's more warm, war torn from the marching of your armies and the dropping of your bombs. The walking on the waters now, stomping on the pond, the ripples not wave. You can't be peaceful with a pistol in your face. You can't beat the people, so you're picking on their place. I jump to defend, I wage with a page. My pen's mightier than them, and I got missiles on the stage. It's couches for the cowards, it stretches for the brave. And I happily lay upon the bed that I have made. Like house key, sheets and pillowcase, but I don't sleep. Dreams is keeping me awake. They went up thinking that they had never touched the ground. But we gon' wish upon them all.
This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Police in the United States have shot and killed more than 500 people in the first half of 2015, according to a count by The Guardian. In fact, the police in the U.S. have killed more in a matter of days than other countries do in years. Most victims are African American. Three experts join us now to help us understand what exactly is going on. Dr. Kimberly Barsamian Khan is a professor of social psychology at Portland State University. She's the author of Racial Bias in Policing, Why We Know Less Than We Should. Alan Zhao is a professor of law and justice at Rowan University. He is the author of Controlling Police Corruption and Misconduct, a comparative examination between Hong Kong and New York, as well as Police Auditing Theories and Practices. Ronald Kramer also joins us. He's a lecturer at the University of Auckland and the author of Neoliberal Prisons and Cognitive Treatment, as well as Missynchronization of Juvenile Reform. Welcome to the Scholar Circle. It's great to have all three of you here with us. We're trying to understand what's going on here on the deeper levels. Kimberly Khan, this is an area that you've been studying, racial bias in policing. Maybe we start about the different levels of bias and how they manifest themselves, both in society and specifically with police forces.
It's really important to consider policing as just a microcosm for the same sort of societal practices and biases that we see across all different domains within society, in education, in healthcare, in organizational structures. What myself and other social psychologists look at are the two kind of different levels of bias, and particularly how modern bias functions. So when we think of traditional attitudes, we tend to think of our explicit or kind of conscious level attitudes. If I ask you what your attitude about a certain racial group is, you can easily respond with your feelings. However, we actually know from psychological research that there's a second level through which attitudes influence behavior, and that's called implicit attitudes or implicit stereotyping. And essentially, this type of bias operates beneath our conscious awareness. So individuals don't even necessarily know that they hold these types of stereotypic biases or associations. And it's really important then to consider that one can hold outwardly, explicitly egalitarian or unprejudiced attitudes, yet still hold these implicit biases. And that really is what makes modern bias so pernicious and pervasive, because many people hold these implicit unconscious biases while not being aware of it and being explicitly not prejudiced. So we end up with a sort of subtle form of modern racism or modern stereotyping and bias, where on the surface conscious level, people think that they're being egalitarian in their behavior, yet in certain situations, those implicit attitudes can actually influence behavior and lead to discriminatory outcomes. And I think we see both of these processes playing out within the policing context as well.
I remember an old experiment called the Dahl test that was back in the 50s and had an effect on Brown versus Board of Education. And I know since then, there have been a series of experiments that have also tested for these sorts of implicit subconscious biases. I wonder if you could give us a bit of an update. If the experiments are showing us that we've changed in society, or if we're still the same as back in the 50s with the Dahl test, what are those experiments that are helping us understand this?
I think that's a great way to kind of get again at this nature of modern prejudice. But what we tend to see over the last 50 years in the psychological literature is that people are less likely to explicitly endorse racial group stereotypes, gender stereotypes. Those overall numbers have gone down. However, what we've seen instead is this increase in implicit bias, in that unconscious bias. So that tends to be where more of the sort of focus is going. What are some of those types of experiments? How do we essentially measure someone's attitudes that are beneath their conscious awareness? And so what psychological researchers have created, one dominant methodology is called the implicit association task. And essentially what this task is we just sort categories and names into different categories that are either stereotype consistent or stereotype inconsistent. So we might have pairings of black and bad and white and good, for example. And the faster we're able just to sort different stimuli into those categories, we're faster to do that when those pairings are already primed in our mind. And so the faster we're able to do those sorting tasks when those sortings are stereotype consistent versus when they're stereotype inconsistent is actually the strength of that implicit attitude that I mentioned. And so when we're talking about these reaction times, we're really thinking about the millisecond level. So we're not able to actually control these differences. But how does that play out and influence our behavior? Well, in the policing context, one way that we see implicit attitudes influence police behavior is through what's called a shooter bias phenomenon. And so this is the idea that police officers, as well as community members, are faster to correctly shoot in simulations African Americans that are carrying guns compared to whites. And then we also make the errors in stereotype consistent ways. So people are more likely to mistakenly shoot unarmed African American targets compared to unarmed whites, and then make the opposite error. So you're more likely to mistakenly not shoot an armed white suspect, so someone that actually is dangerous, compared to an armed black suspect. So we can create these types of psychological simulations, and at this millisecond level, people are using race as a cue to understand whether or not to shoot or not shoot an individual based on the danger perceptions that we hold.
Is this part of what I saw in your work called weapon misidentification too?
Absolutely. So weapon misidentification is built off of this idea of shooter bias. So essentially, it's how the racial stereotypes that we hold at this implicit level bias our decision making in these sort of shoot, don't shoot simulations. So we get at how those implicit stereotypes are actually driving and biasing behavior.
So Alan Zhao, let's bring you in now and talk about how culture affects this type of police behavior. What are your findings telling us?
I look at kind of the other aspect of this organizational issues regarding police corruption, police misconduct, from mostly an organizational and institutional perspective. Basically, what I look at is how organizations change over time. And say from a corrupt police department to a much cleaner police department, from a department that engaged in a lot of misconduct, a lot of scandals, to a relatively more rights-conscious and more protection of individual civil rights, constitutional rights. Those kinds of departments, basically in the United States, I studied the changes in the Los Angeles Police Department from the earliest Rodney King beating. That's probably the first videotaped incident. And to the present, you hardly hear very much from Los Angeles these days. There is a good reason for that, because after the Rodney King beating incident, there was this Christopher Commission. And then the Rampart Board of Inquiry, the LAPD basically reached a consent decree with the Federal Department of Justice. And under that decree, the LAPD was mandated to carry out a series of reform, and they created an audit division conducting about 50 audits per year, and then report the results of the audits and the response to those audits to a federal judge. And the entire department has changed over time. In a way, I like to use the LAPD as an example that a corrupt department with a lot of violation of individual rights, police brutality against African Americans, minorities, they can change. In a way, it's not been discussed much in the public media, but in a way, I believe the LAPD actually can be considered as a model today.
Do you know, Alan Zhao, sorry to interrupt you, how much it changed? Do you know, like, how many incidents, say, percentage-wise, have decreased or reduced, or how much of an impact it did make, that commission?
Yes, LAPD actually has successfully completed the decree. In other words, they have demonstrated compliance with all the issues identified in the consent decree, and the federal judge basically has said you have passed the test. The consent decree is focused on what they call pattern and practice. There's a constitutional violation to the point where it's a pattern and practice, not just individual incidents. And that pattern and practice has been, in a way, they can say, drastically reduced. And these days, they still happen. Obviously, it's isolated incidents. So the pattern and practice probably has been drastically eliminated. And so in a sense, we can also look at all the surveys and the numbers. And based on their records and the citizen survey, there has been a much better relationship and trust between the police and the community. So basically, the police are very difficult to change because their culture and their history, their tradition, their paramilitary nature, it's very difficult to change the police, which is very, very well documented. But there are stories of success, both in the United States and overseas. I was in Hong Kong for 1 year just to study the transition from the Royal Hong Kong Police to a Chinese military region police, how the Hong Kong police transformed from a syndically corrupt police department in 1970s to a department today that is relatively free of corruption. And they have gone through about 3 decades of change. Basically, I view it as a dramatic cultural transformation, and there are many factors that contributed to the change. One major factor is, in a way, it's another version of the consent decree, but in Hong Kong is the ICAC, which is the Independent Commission Against Corruption, which is an extremely powerful external oversight agency, leaving no stones unturned, looking into every corrupt case within the Hong Kong police. Over time, police officers just know, if you are corrupt, you will be caught. They actually tell each other not to be corrupt. So that's a sea change from the 1970s when everybody was corrupt. So my research basically says that police can change, but it takes maybe 2 decades, maybe 3 decades to transform the culture of the police. But the force of this change usually was imposed upon the police coming from the outside. Most of the time, that seemed to be the case. Now, obviously, inside is important too, but usually it's the public outcry that forced an institutional change, not just a commission, a temporary commission or a temporary investigation. The consent decree is different from the Christopher Commission, from the Rampart Board of Inquiry, from many temporary investigative agencies all around the world. They don't seem to work very well, including the Civilian Review Board. They are incident-driven. They're not put in there to watch over this agency through a legal system and through the justice system. In case of the consent decree, it's entirely different from the Christopher Commission report. It's a legal document. The LAPD was the defendant. The Department of Justice of the federal government was the plaintiff. That's the legal document. They have to comply. If they don't comply, something consequential is going to happen to the police department. And this audit division has become part of the institution. And even though the consent decree has been completed, audit division continue to conduct audits, 50 audits a year. And that has become part of the institutionalized culture. Over time, based on my research, the police commanders have also become more receptive to the function, to the practices of this audit division. From the earlier resentment and sabotage, if you will, to the present cooperation, they actually look at it as a way to help them improve their operations, to improve their job. In the same way, the Hong Kong police actually view the ICAC in a much more positive term. So things can change. There are models there to follow. There are best practices in the United States, such as the early warning system, the use of force policy, Civilian Review Board. In recent years, there has been a trend called this Office of Independent Police Auditor. That has been developed mostly in western part of the United States. Probably about 50 cities already have it. A municipal independent agency charged with the responsibility to investigate police corruption and police misconduct, which is an external agency, not part of the police, usually operate directly under the mayor or city council. So these kinds of mechanism I view as best practices in rooting out the scandals we've been seeing in Ferguson and Baltimore.
Ronald Kramer, what do you make of all this?
My work is more about social structure, social inequality, and criminal justice, a bit more broadly conceived and things like that. So I think it's interesting to hear the LAPD of all places, you know, as becoming a model of good policing. But I think the flip side of that for me is, while there is change and while that is possible, But on the other side of that, there's a very long history of ongoing structural oppression, persistent forms of discrimination across all aspects of criminal justice. I sort of see all this as largely connected to growing social inequalities. The last 40, 45 years under neoliberal regimes and governments, neoliberal forms of statecrafting, life has gotten worse and worse for the vast majority of people. Inequality has gotten incredibly worse. The gap has grown, especially in the US. It's growing in New Zealand. Same case in Australia, pretty much the same thing in the UK. All those sort of neoliberal countries have seen those same sorts of transformations, precarious labor, exclusion from the labor market, and things like that. And that often correlates with race, which I think is a reflection of the fact that capitalism is a, you know, racially discriminatory economic order. And then what we seem to be doing more and more in the last, you know, in this same period is turning to criminal justice, turning to the police to sort of manage the social problems that follow as inequality gets worse. I think in that context, places like LA, the LAPD, I would guess they're more likely to be something of the exception to the rule, which is a little more pessimistic, sorry to say. When we look at all the criminal justice figures, it's not really a story of progress for the most part. Incarceration is getting worse and worse. There seems to be, if anything, more and more incidents of police brutality and excessive police force, especially in the US. And I think the other thing to think about, the police shootings, the arresting the teenagers at a pool party, and I don't know, that cop rolling around on the ground in the video, all those kinds of absurdities. In some sense, they're on the extreme end. The other side to this is the more, you know, the everyday kind of policing. When I was in New York, I was doing a study on young men in Rikers Island who were in a cognitive treatment program. And one of the things they would sort of talk a lot about is just the ongoing police presence in their neighborhood. It didn't always need to be a shooting. It was just constant harassment going on in the neighborhood and things like that. So I think that sort of signifies it's an uphill battle to sort of correct those broader structural problems. And I think it's nice to see that there is things at the organizational level or organizational sort of mechanisms and best practices that you can implement. But I think we need to be aware of the task and the problem that we're really up against if we're interested in seeing, you know, what could be called progressive or, you know, less violent forms of policing or whatever you want to call it.
I wonder, too, when we look at China and Hong Kong in comparison to, say, the United States has got more diversity both in terms of race and ethnicity and also in terms of the economic structures. And I wonder, Alan Zhao, if you think that the heterogeneity in the United States makes it more complicated than, say, the systems that you studied in China in terms of in-group and out-group and cultural differences, that sort of a thing. What's your sense about that?
Hong Kong has a very different culture, obviously. Hong Kong is known for having a very low crime rate in recent years. But racism or discrimination against certain members of certain ethnic group, they do exist in Hong Kong as well. It's just they haven't come up as scandals covered in the media. Obviously, they haven't got that serious in Hong Kong. But the police officers I talked to when I was there, they actually have a even more open discriminatory attitudes than American police officers I talked to. United States is a very sensitive because the racial issue. You really don't hear much about racism when you talk to police officers, but you talk to a Hong Kong police officer, they are openly racist in a way. They don't think it's anything wrong to say that why you wear the scarf, you want to live here, you live like a Chinese person. It's yourself to blame. The civil rights, that part have not caught up. They've done a great job controlling crime in Hong Kong and have done a great job controlling corruption. And to a certain extent, they also have done a great job controlling misconduct, misbehavior. But actually, one weak area in the Hong Kong police that I saw is civil rights and is areas like the United States have developed much further ahead, such as domestic violence legislation. Hong Kong, when I was there, still did not have any laws governing domestic violence. It is remained a family issue that police simply did not want to be involved in. And the United States was like that in the 1970s. It's like 40 years ago. And these days, a lot more protection and legal protection has been created for women, for minorities. So the rights consciousness was much stronger in the United States, even though the media seemed to portray, obviously, a lot more problems. In a way, I agree with Ron, actually. It is extremely difficult to change the culture and mindsets and behavior of police organization, both at the organizational level and at the individual level, which is why my research has pointed to the importance of not just a simple change, not just a simple commission sent to investigate. It really has to get to the point of institutionalized change. The change should continue regardless who was the chief of police, regardless who was there today or gone tomorrow. And oftentimes it's based on an individual person there, and the person is gone, the whole program is gone. Institutionalized change means the culture has to be created and established. And that would take, as I said earlier, years and even decades. And somebody has to be there as a permanent body holding them accountable, like the ICAC in Hong Kong and this consent decree in Los Angeles. There's a reason why they have changed. They were forced to change initially, but eventually they become receptive and they welcome this oversight. And the United States, I agree, this is not a rule. It is an exception, unfortunately, it is true. But they do exist. I want to shed a positive light. Another example is Oakland, which is not too far. It's also in Los Angeles. Oakland used to be extremely corrupt. The officers there, it just about everybody was behaving extremely badly. They could kill somebody and be covered up. Everybody would protect them. It's because of public protests about 15, 20 years ago, very, very strong protests citywide that forced the Oakland police to change. And these days, Oakland police is also getting much better. I'm not saying that the problem, have stopped. But they are making progress in many areas. It is still rare and far and rare in between. But I think that the police are required. Unfortunately, they're not forced to do anything. The police in America are all independent. There's no national police system. Nobody has to do anything. We're all under the mayor, under each city, So if the police are required, say, to follow a set of what I like to call the best practices in policing, if they are mandated, let's say, by some kind of a legal mechanism, oversight, that they have to have a set of best practices in place and on a permanent basis. We all know what they are. They are best practices. There are probably 10, 15, 20 best practices models already out there. But they are not required to be followed. And unfortunately, probably 90% of the police department don't follow those best practices, even though they're readily available to follow. For example, early warning system can be easily adopted. Many agencies still don't use it. And it's simple as that. Independent police auditor can be easily created, but very few cities do that in the United States. So it is a very difficult task ahead, which I totally agree with Ron, and require institutionalized effort, not just a temporary police investigative commission. It's not just something like that. So that whoever wants to make the change have to have this long-term commitment to making the change happen at the institutional level as well as the individual level.
Kimberly Kahn, let's bring you back in then. Are these best practices going to help us to deal with these subconscious racial biases?
And that's the tricky part. Not necessarily. As we can find, we might see these best practices and these structural changes we can make within departments, change some of those explicit norms or ideas. Policing is still happening within the broader societal context. And if we're not changing the broader societal context and the structures, the way our stereotypes have already been implicitly adopted and embedded in our mind are still going to function within those contexts. So those implicit attitudes that I was talking about before are really created by just the knowledge of these cultural stereotypes that link, racial minorities or blacks with criminality and violence. And what we see is those stereotypes then impact our daily decisions and our behaviors in both overt ways as well as these subtle ways. So it might bias where an officer's natural attention goes to in a crowd. It's going to change and shape the information that we take in to be in line with the stereotype. So So we might see an ambiguous action and interpret it as more threatening or dangerous when it's done by an African-American suspect compared to a white suspect. It might then, you know, influence our interactions when police are interacting with minorities. And then it might also influence the level of force if the incident actually escalates. And all of this can be done then beneath people's conscious awareness. So changing the explicit norms and changing the institutional structure is certainly a really good starting point, but it doesn't really get at the more prevalent influence of these implicit biases in directing police behavior.
Does it matter who decides to become an officer? Is there a type of person who decides to enter the police force? And within that police force, there's got to be a culture that develops in a sort of in-group, out-group thinking. Is there a phenomenon there that can be or should be addressed?
From a psychological profile, there does tend to be a certain type of individual that is attracted, is more likely to enter the policing realm. They tend to, you know, be a little more kind of comfortable with sort of dominance and power and kind of enforcing control and authority. Those are some of the basic tenets that are part of an officer's job. So it tends to attract those types of individuals to a greater extent compared to another type of job. So we have some self-selection of individuals that are more kind of into or comfortable with sort of taking authority, leadership, kind of power and control over a situation. So that can kind of start to lead situations to already have that power basic and that basis and that moral authority given to the officer.
And then what about training? How much
training,
does that matter?
Absolutely. You know, and with training academies, as police go through the academy, that's where officers tend to learn those norms. We know that policing, for example, is a very masculine focused arena or focused domain. So those masculine type ideas of control and power and authority tend to be emphasized, learned, and adopted in the academy, which then translate into their police officers' work in the field. And that's really where those types of institutional norms that we're talking about earlier are first learned. And so any kind of change, you really want to start at that academy level, going all the way through the upper echelon and leadership within the department.
Alan Zhao, what do you say about that?
My research basically suggests that the police profession obviously draws those personalities Kim just described, but also other kinds of people, because young people actually in the United States, at least, are drawn to the police profession basically because of the media. Basically, it's a free advertising for the police profession, the FBI, the cop show, and all this court TV. The power for influencing the officers to a great extent come from the time after they enter the police force, after they finish the training. The first 6 months to about a year, what we call this probationary period in police departments, police officers would go through a very powerful socialization process. Either you are in or you are out. And it is an extremely powerful process that pretty much shaped and changed a lot of people's personalities to conform to the norm of whether it's bad or good. It's, oftentimes, if it's a corrupt culture, you would be forced to be part of that. Or if it's a good culture, you become part of that. But at the end, I think that socialization process needs to be recognized. That's why this institutional cultural program is extremely important to make sure that a more positive, right conscious principles need to be indoctrinated in the mind and hearts of these officers. Those in the first year, extremely important. Obviously, officers like to follow their relatives and parents or grandparents. Somebody did a study called Dangerous Footstep, basically like four different generations of cops in the United States. And so that represents a certain pattern. But based on my students that I teach, they come from all walks and backgrounds. They're all drawn to this profession because of what they see on TV, pretty much. But at the end, somebody else, I forgot his name, did a study. Actually, he compared four different personalities of four different police officers, and they actually approach incidents, respond to incidents, dealing with the same problem in four different ways. So they still have some discretion. They still can do things that reflect their different personality. They don't use the same methods to, let's say, to deal with domestic violence. And some officers would avoid, try not to do the paperwork. Others would come in from this social justice perspective. Others would look at it from a sociological perspective, you know, look at the children, look at the parents, look at the who's going to bring the food to the table. Other people just like, I'm here for justice. I don't care who you are. I'm going to arrest the person. So there are four different perspectives dealing with the same issue. So personalities still matter. They're not all the same, even though maybe in terms of relationship, who they hang out with, you know, they have to conform with their fellow officer, but they do work on an individual basis in the United States. They work alone most of the time. So when they deal with problems, they have all kinds of discretions.
Ronald Kramer, what do you say to all this?
Yeah, I kind of feel we're going to be caught between the sort of how much conscious manipulation can go on and how the extent to which that can challenge sort of, as I should have said before, like the kind of social structure that I was talking about, I think it does weave its way into the sort of mindset and the sort of subjectivity of people and things like that. So I feel we're sort of trapped between these, what we consciously can do against the structures that we're in and the sort of subjectivity that we bring to them. The thing that triggered for me was I think there's actually quite a common social phenomenon on some sense. People go into a profession with whatever motive they may have, but they come out of it, or once they are on the other side and involved in that profession, they tend to do whatever the structure asks and demands of them. I see, for, you know, just this is a bit anecdotal, obviously, but I can't tell you how many law students I've met who wanted to be Erin Brockovich or whatever, and then they get into the legal field and they realize how the law actually operates or something like that, you know. And again, I really probably shouldn't say this, again, completely anecdotal, but, you know, academics, it's like, hey, let's all teach and be like these inspirations to people. And then you get inside an academic institution and you realize, you know, no one really cares about that. It's what's your research? What are you doing? Are you getting funded? And that's sort of, then you become that kind of academic.
I saw the same thing in the state legislature, too. Exactly. Want to get in, change the world, and conformity.
You know, so a lot, I think there's... There's these sort of ritualistic elements of entering any given profession. And again, I think the police force probably has a pretty disturbing version of that. I've heard that said in the New Zealand context in some of the interviews I've done around criminal justice, people saying you learn all this stuff in the academy and then the first cop you're on the beat with or whatever pulls you aside and says this is how it really works and things like that. So I think we're still up against that dynamic of how much can you sort of consciously or sort of through programs manipulate the structures that people are embedded within and things like that. And again, I understand there can be best practices and very positive versions of that. But again, I think it's still evident that we have a significant problem in these regards. And so the question becomes perhaps something, what's the likelihood or how is it that you can promote those kinds of programs and get buy-in to them or something like that? Maybe it's time to start thinking strategically about how you can implement those kinds of things in a consistent fashion.
It brings to mind something I saw in your work too, Alan Zhao, which is about community policing. What has been the impact of that?
Community policing, I think, is a great way to bridge the gap between the police and the community, obviously. Again, community policing can only work if the police actually have developed a community-oriented culture. Again, this cannot be at the rhetoric level or some leader, police manager wants to do it. The police office, the rank and file have to have this buy-in process, has become part of their culture. And that part, I don't think has taken place in most places, just like everything else. It hasn't happened, even though community policing has been around, you know, since the 80s, since the team policing program was put into place in the 70s. But based on my research, it really hasn't taken root, even though it's a catchy word, it's a buzzword that everybody likes to use. And over time, actually, it has been eroded after the 9/11 terrorist attack, because the funding from the federal government for community policing has all been diverted to Homeland Security, and the police basically have been reverted back to the traditional bureaucratic professional model, which what we like to call today, they like to use the word evidence-based policing or intelligence-based policing. These new words keep coming up. You know, community policing is seemed to be an old concept already, even though it has never taken root in the first place. But again, one more word. But if a department, again, would like to use a good model, like the San Diego Police Department, actually, I think is a good model for community policing, at least in the, say, 20 years ago, again, it's because it was institutionalized. It's not just the isolated anecdotal program somebody liked and created in one day, then a person left the force the next year. It is something that the San Diego Police Department wants to use as a guiding principle for every division, every program, every unit, not just a separate, say, community policing program within a patrol division, which is what most places do. They actually use the same idea to govern the operations of every police activity. So you have to do something like that, really committed to this idea. Understand this is not just a catchy phrase to use, as require a lot of changes, like including how you promote officers, how you evaluate officers. It's not just counting how many arrests you have made and how many tickets you have given, but also look at the compliments, how many problems you have solved, how many collaborative effort you have, how many people have reached out. So that has to be a different evaluation system put into place. And most departments, unfortunately, don't want to go that far. And they're comfortable with just counting arrests, counting tickets, not comfortable with this, you know, soft criteria. They like to use the hard criteria, as they say. So that's why it's difficult to do. I think it's a culture they have to create. And by the way, I don't think community policing is a concept that came from the United States. Even a lot of people think it came from the United States. Actually, it came from Japan. David Bailey, the first person who created this term, he used those two words to characterize the Japanese policing. So the first American scholar used that phrase, and people think it came from America, actually came from Japan. He used those two terms to describe the Japanese way of policing, the Koban system, which existed in Japan, obviously does not exist in the United States.
I know they were also trying something like that in Northern Ireland, where there was historically, the police were used to oppress the Irish Catholic community, and they were trying to do some form of community policing to try to make that a more equitable system. Kimberly Kahn, where do you think we should go to create a more just police force and justice system?
That's the difference of going from just that enforcement model, which is what was sort of just described, to the more community engagement type model, the more kind of collaborative policing approach, where, again, you're really valuing positive interactions between officers and citizens. And that's seen as part of normal police work and just as important as the number of citations or arrests that you made. And so why does community policing have such a buzzword, or why does that have potentially these better outcomes? Is because if it's done correctly and with the community, it can increase the trust in police that community members have, and particularly the minority community. So what we tend to see is that minority group members tend to have lower levels of trust in the police than majority group members. And this creates a disconnect between the police and the communities that they're trying to serve. And we know that lower levels of trust in police then affect people's willingness to cooperate with the police, willingness to call the police if they are a victim of the crime. And part of police officers' jobs and ability to do their jobs well is that connection with the community to get tips, to get information, to help solve crimes. And when we have this gap in trust in police, then it makes police actually less effective at their overall job. And so what these positive community interactions, police suspect interactions can have, is actually serve to try to reduce that gap in trust between racial minorities and majority group members by having more of these positive, non-investigatory contacts. Simply going out and meeting the community members, talking to businesses, business owners, learning about the problems in the community, In our local context, we have officers go out to attend the sporting event games, for example, and pass out stickers with kids. And it's all of those basic interactions where community members start to see police just in their normal daily lives and in a non-investigatory way that helps to create that trust and create that bond, which then leads to more positive police community relationships and interactions afterwards.
Ronald Kramer?
No, thanks. I agree with most of what's been said. The only thing I would sort of add is, one is community policing can mean a whole bunch of different things, as was intimated in New York. I think it clearly meant something different than how some other places understood it. And again, as a sociologist, the more broader point for me, one of the things I think we need to start thinking about is, I think we're too dependent on criminal justice. I think we ask the criminal justice system to do too much for us at this point. So I think, you know, we need to think of ways to minimize our dependence on police, minimize our dependence on courts and prisons and things like that. One of the things I sort of didn't say before was that as we've sort of seen criminal justice expand, we've seen other forms of social support be eradicated over this same time period. And so I think there, alongside more progressive ideas about how to police, there also needs to be more progressive ideas or reinvestments in old sort of public infrastructure, social security systems that were previously in place in many of these sorts of places. Well, at least my focus being the more sort of so-called Western democracies in some sense. So they've been eradicated. You know, it came up before that there's the introduction of specialized courts, you know, in the US around family violence. That's just one example of what I'm talking about. There's a proliferation of specialized courts now, family violence courts, drug courts. In New Zealand, we have a homelessness court effectively, right? In a lot of ways, family violence perhaps not so much, but drugs, homelessness, they're fundamental social problems. I don't understand why we're asking criminal justice to... I don't understand why we're tasking criminal justice with those issues. But we have no alternative social model. So I think in conjunction with rethinking how we police, we need to rethink and reinvest in social security that we in some places took for granted in the 60s, 70s, you know, to some extent.
I think this was a profound discussion. We got to a lot of things in a short amount of time. Thank you, all three of you, for being with us. Alan Zhao, Kimberly Khan, and Ronald Kramer. What a great pleasure to host you.
Thanks.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Kimberly Barsamian Khan is a professor of social psychology at Portland State University. She's the author of Racial Bias in Policing, Why We Know Less Than We Should. Alan Zhao is a professor of law and justice at Rowan University. He is the author of Controlling Police Corruption and Misconduct, a comparative examination between Hong Kong and New York, as well as Police Auditing Theories and Practices. Ronald Kramer is a lecturer at the University of Auckland and the author of Neoliberal Prisons and Cognitive Treatment, as well as Missynchronization of Juvenile Reform. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.